A ball of light, at least 10 feet in diameter, tumbled over the edge of the horizon, sizzling hot, and at first arrowed straight toward the train. "Holy shit," Jack muttered to himself, remembering what Anders had said about the balls of fire. "If a man gets too close to one of those fireballs, he gets terrible sick, loses his air, sores and apteres all over his body. He begins to vomit, vomits and vomits, until his stomach ruptures and his throat bursts." He swallowed hard. It was like swallowing a pound of nails. "Please God," he said aloud. The giant ball of light sped straight toward him, as though it owned a mind and had decided to erase Jack Sawyer and Richard Sloat from the earth. Radiation poisoning. Jack's stomach contracted and his testicles froze up under his body. Radiation poisoning. Vomits and vomits until his stomach ruptures. The excellent dinner Anders had given him nearly leaped out of his stomach. The fireball continued to roll straight toward the train, shooting out sparks and sizzling with its own fiery energy. Behind it lengthened a glowing golden trail, which seemed magically to instigate other snapping, burning lines in the red earth. Just when the fireball bounced up off the earth and took a zagging bounce like a giant tennis ball, wandering harmlessly off to the left, Jack had his first clear glimpse of the creatures he had all along thought were following them. The reddish golden light of the wandering fireball and the residual glow of the old trails in the earth illuminated a group of deformed-looking beasts which had evidently been following the train. They were dogs, or once had been dogs, or their ancestors had been dogs, and Jack glanced uneasily at Richard to make sure that he was still sleeping. The creatures falling behind the train flattened down on the ground like snakes. Their heads were dog-like, Jack saw, but their bodies had only vestigial hind legs, and were, as far as he could see, hairless and tailless. They looked wet. The pink, hairless skin glistened, like that of newborn mice. They snarled, hating to be seen. It had been these awful mutant dogs that Jack had seen on the banks of the railway cutting. Exposed, flattened out like reptiles, they hissed and snarled and began creeping away. They, too, feared the fireballs and the trails the fireballs left on the earth. Then Jack caught the odor of the fireball, now moving swiftly, somehow almost angrily, toward the horizon again, igniting an entire row of the stunted trees. Hellfire. Corruption. Another of the fireballs came cruising over the horizon and blazed away off to the boy's left. The stink of missed connections, of blasted hopes and evil desires. Jack, with his heart lodged just under his tongue, imagined he found all this in the foul smell broadcast by the fireball. Mewing, the crowd of mutant dogs had dispersed into the threat of glinting teeth, a whisper of surreptitious movement, the hush-hush-hush of heavy, legless bodies dragged through red dust. How many of them were there? From the base of a burning tree which tried to hide its head in its trunk, two of the deformed dogs bared long teeth at him. Then another fireball lurched over the wide horizon, spinning off a wide, glowing track a distance from the train, and Jack momentarily glimpsed what looked like a ramshackle little shed set just below the curve of the desert wall. Before it stood a large humanoid figure, male, looking toward him. An impression of size, hairiness, force, malice. Jack was indelibly conscious of the slowness of Anders' little train, of his and Richard's exposure to anything that might want to investigate them a little more closely. The first fireball had dispatched the horrible dog things, but human residents of the blasted lands might prove more difficult to overcome. Before the light diminished into the glowing trail, Jack saw that the figure before the shed was following his progress, turning a great shaggy head as the train passed by. If what he had seen were dogs, then what would the people be like? In the last of the flaring light from the ball of fire, the man-like being scuttled around the side of its dwelling. A thick reptilian tail swung from its hindquarters, and then the thing had slipped around the side of the building, and then it was dark again, and nothing, dogs, man, beast, shed, was visible. Jack could not even be sure that he had really seen it. Richard jerked in his sleep. and Jack pushed his hand against the simple gear shift, vainly trying for more speed. The dog noises gradually faded behind them. Sweating, Jack raised his left wrist again to the level of his eyes and saw that only 15 minutes had passed since the last time he'd checked his watch. He astonished himself by yawning again and again regretted eating so much at the depot. "No!" Richard screamed. "No! I can't go there!" There, Jack wondered, where was there? California? Or was it anywhere threatening, anywhere Richard's precarious control, as insecure as an unbroken horse, might slip away from him? All night Jack stood at the gear shift while Richard slept, watching the trails of the departed fireballs flicker along the reddish surface of the earth. Their odor of dead flowers and hidden corruption filled the air. From time to time he heard the chatter of the mutant dogs or of other poor creatures rising from the roots of the stunted, ingrown trees which still dotted the landscape. The ranks of batteries occasionally sent up snapping arcs of blue. Richard was in a state beyond mere sleep, wrapped in an unconsciousness he both required and had willed. He made no more tortured outcries. In fact, he did nothing but slump into his corner of the cab and breathe shallowly, as if even respiration took more energy than he had. Jack half prayed for, half feared the coming of the light. When morning came, he would be able to see the animals, but what else might he have to see? From time to time, he glanced over at Richard. His friend's skin seemed oddly pale, an almost ghostly shade of gray. Morning came with a relaxation of the darkness. A band of pink appeared along the bowl-like edge of the eastern horizon, and soon a rosy stripe grew up beneath it, pushing the optimistic pinkness higher in the sky. Jack's eyes felt almost as red as that stripe, and his legs ached. Richard lay across the whole of the cab's little seat, still breathing in a restricted, almost reluctant way. It was true, Jack saw. Richard's face did seem peculiarly gray. His eyelids fluttered in a dream, and Jack hoped that his friend was not about to erupt in another of his screams. Richard's mouth dropped open, but what emerged was the tip of his tongue, not a loud outcry. Richard passed his tongue along his upper lip, snorted, then fell back into his stupefied coma. Although Jack wished desperately to sit down and close his own eyes, he did not disturb Richard. For the more Jack saw as the new light filled in the details of the blasted lands, the more he hoped Richard's unconsciousness would endure as long as he himself could endure the conditions of Anders' cranky little train. He was anything but eager to witness the response of Richard Sloat to the idiosyncrasies of the blasted lands. A small amount of pain, a quantity of exhaustion, these were a minimal price to pay for what he knew must be a temporary peace. What he saw through his squinting eyes was a landscape in which nothing seemed to have escaped withering, crippling damage. By moonlight it had seemed a vast desert, though a desert furnished with trees. Now Jack took in that his desert was actually nothing of the sort. What he had taken for a reddish variety of sand was a loose, powdery soil. It looked as though a man would sink in it up to his ankles, if not his knees. From this starved, dry soil grew the wretched trees. Looked at directly, these were much as they had appeared by night, so stunted they seemed to be straining over in an attempt to flee back under their own coiling roots. This was bad enough for rational Richard, anyhow. But when you saw one of these trees obliquely, out of the side of your eye, then you saw a living creature in torment. The straining branches were arms thrown up over an agonized face caught in a frozen scream. As long as Jack was not looking directly at the trees, he saw their tortured faces in perfect detail. The open O of the mouth, the staring eyes and the drooping nose, the long, agonized wrinkles running down the cheeks. They were cursing, pleading, howling at him. Their unheard voices hung in the air like smoke. Jack groaned. Like all the blasted lands, these trees had been poisoned. The reddish land stretched out for miles on either side, dotted here and there with patches of acrid-looking yellow grass, bright as urine or new paint. If it had not been for the hideous coloration of the long grass, these areas would have resembled oases, for each lay beside a small, round body of water. The water was black, and oily patches floated on its skin. Thicker than water, somehow, itself oily, poisonous. The second of these false oases that Jack saw began to ripple sluggishly as the train went past, and at first Jack thought with horror that the black water itself was alive, a being as tormented as the trees he no longer wished to see. Then he momentarily saw something break the surface of the thick fluid, a broad black back or side, which rolled over before a wide, ravenous mouth appeared, biting down on nothing. A suggestion of scales that would have been iridescent if the creature had not been discolored by the pool. Holy cow, Jack thought. Was that a fish? It seemed to him to have been nearly 20 feet long, too big to inhabit the little pool. A long tail roiled the water before the entire enormous creature slipped back down into what must have been the pool's considerable depth. Jack looked up sharply at the horizon, imagining that he had momentarily seen the round shape of a head peering over it. And then he had another of those shocks of a sudden displacement, similar to that the Loch Ness Monster, or whatever it was, had given him. How could a head peer over the horizon, for God's sake? Because the horizon wasn't the real horizon, he finally understood. All night, and for as long as it took him to really see what lay at the end of his vision, he had drastically underestimated the size of the blasted lands. Jack finally understood, as the sun began to force its way up into the world again, that he was in a broad valley, and the rim, far off to either side, was not the edge of the world, but the craggy top of a range of hills. Anybody or anything could be tracking him, keeping just out of sight past the rim of the surrounding hills. He remembered the humanoid being with the crocodile's tail that had slipped around the side of the little shed. Could he have been following Jack all night, waiting for him to fall asleep? The train poop-pooped through the lurid valley, moving with a suddenly maddening lack of speed. He scanned the entire rim of hills about him, seeing nothing but new morning sunlight gild the upright rocks far above him. Jack turned around completely in the cab, fear and tension for the moment completely negating his tiredness. Richard threw one arm over his eyes and slept on. Anything, anybody might have been keeping pace with them, waiting them out. A slow, almost hidden movement off to his left made him catch his breath. A movement huge, slithery. Jack had a vision of a half dozen of the crocodile men crawling over the rim of the hills toward him, and he shielded his eyes with his hands and stared at the place where he thought he had seen them. The rocks were stained the same red as the powdery soil, and between them a deep trail wound its way over the crest of the hills through a cleft in the high-standing rocks. What was moving between two of the standing rocks was a shape not even vaguely human. It was a snake, at least Jack thought it was. It had slipped into a concealed section of the trail, and Jack saw only a huge, sleek, round reptilian body disappearing behind the rocks. The skin of the creature seemed oddly ridged, burned too, a suggestion, just before it disappeared, of ragged black holes in its side. Jack craned to see the place where it would emerge, and in seconds witnessed the wholly unnerving spectacle of the head of a giant worm, one quarter buried in the thick red dust, swiveling toward him. It had hooded, filmy eyes, but it was the head of a worm. Some other animal bolted from under a rock, heavy head and dragging body, and as the worm's big head darted toward it, Jack saw that the fleeing creature was one of the mutant dogs. The worm opened a mouth like the slot of a corner mailbox and neatly scooped up the frantic dog thing. Jack clearly heard the snapping of bones. The dog's wailing ceased. The huge worm swallowed the dog as neatly as if it were a pill. Now, immediately before the worm's monstrous form, lay one of the black trails left by the fireballs. And as Jack watched, the long creature burrowed into the dust like a cruise ship sinking beneath the surface of the ocean. It apparently understood that the traces of the fireballs could do it damage, and, worm-like, it would dig beneath them. Jack watched as the ugly thing completely disappeared into the red powder, and then cast his eyes uneasily over the whole of the long red slope, dotted with pubic outpatches of the shiny yellow grass, wondering where it would surface again. When he could be at least reasonably certain that the worm was not going to try to ingest the train, Jack went back to inspecting the ridge of rocky hills about him. Before Richard woke up late that afternoon, Jack saw at least one unmistakable head peering over the rim of the hills, two more jouncing and deadly fireballs careering down at him, the headless skeleton of what he at first took to be a large rabbit, then sickeningly knew was a human baby, picked shiningly clean, lying beside the tracks, and closely followed by the round, babyish, gleaming skull of the same baby, half-sunk in the loose soil. And he saw a pack of the big-headed dogs, more damaged than the others he had seen, pathetically come crawling after the train, drooling with hunger. Three bored shacks, human habitations, propped up over the thick dust on stilts, promising that somewhere out in that stinking, poisoned wilderness which was the blasted lands, other people schemed and hunted for food. A small leathery bird, featherless, with this a real territory's touch, a bearded monkey-like face, and clearly delineated fingers protruding from the tips of its wings. And worst of all, apart from what he thought he saw, two completely unrecognizable animals drinking from one of the black pools. Animals with long teeth and human eyes, and forequarters like those of pigs, hindquarters like those of big cats. Their faces were matted with hair. As the train pulled past the animals, Jack saw that the testicles of the male had swollen to the size of pillows and sagged onto the ground. What had made such monstrosities? Nuclear damage, Jack supposed, since scarcely anything else had such power to deform nature. The creatures, themselves poisoned from birth, snuffled up the equally poisoned water and snarled at the little train as it passed. Our world could look like this someday, Jack thought. What a treat. Then there were the things he thought he saw. His skin began to feel hot and itchy. He had already dumped the serape-like overgarment which had replaced Miles P. Kiger's coat onto the floor of the cab. Before noon, he stripped off his homespun shirt, too. There was a terrible taste in his mouth, an acidic combination of rusty metal and rotten fruit. Sweat ran from his hairline into his eyes. He was so tired he began to dream standing up, eyes open and stinging with sweat. He saw great packs of the obscene dogs scuttling over the hills. He saw the reddish clouds overhead open up and reach down for Richard and himself with long, flaming arms, devil's arms. When at last his eyes finally did close, he saw Morgan of Oris, 12 feet tall and dressed in black, shooting thunderbolts all around him, tearing the earth into great dusty spouts and craters. Richard groaned and muttered, "No! No, no." Morgan of Oris blew apart like a wisp of fog, and Jack's painful eyes flew open. "Jack," Richard said. The red land ahead of the train was empty but for the blackened trails of the fireballs. Jack wiped his eyes and looked at Richard, feebly stretching. "Yeah," he said. "How are you?" Richard lay back against the stiff seat, blinking out of his drawn gray face. "Sorry I asked," Jack said. "No," Richard said. "I'm better, really." And Jack felt at least a portion of his tension leave him. "I still have a headache, but I'm better." "You are making a lot of noise in your... Jack said, unsure of how much reality his friend could stand. "In my sleep, yeah, I guess I probably did." Richard's face worked, but for once Jack did not brace himself against a scream. "I know I'm not dreaming now, Jack, and I know I don't have a brain tumor." "Do you know where you are?" on that train, that old man's train, in what he called the blasted lands. "Well, I'll be double damned," Jack said, smiling. Richard blushed beneath his gray pallor. "What brought this on?" Jack asked, still not quite sure that he could trust Richard's transformation. "Well, I knew I wasn't dreaming," Richard said, and his cheeks grew even redder. I guess it was just time to stop fighting it. If we're in the territories, then we're in the territories, no matter how impossible it is." His eyes found Jack's, and the trace of humor in them startled his friend. "You remember that gigantic hourglass back in the depot?" When Jack nodded, Richard said, "Well, that was it, really. When I saw that thing, I knew I wasn't just making everything up, because I knew I couldn't have made up that thing. Couldn't. Just couldn't. If I were going to invent a primitive clock, it'd have all sorts of wheels and big pulleys. It wouldn't be so simple, so I didn't make it up. Therefore, it was real. Therefore, everything else was real, too." "Well, how do you feel now?" Jack asked. "You've been asleep for a long time." "I'm still so tired I can hardly hold my head up. I don't feel very good in general, I'm afraid." "Richard, I have to ask you this. Is there some reason why you'd be afraid to go to California?" Richard looked down and shook his head. "Have you ever heard of a place called the Black Hotel?" Richard continued to shake his head. He was not telling the truth, but as Jack recognized, he was facing as much of it as he could. Anything more, for Jack was suddenly sure that there was more, quite a lot of it, would have to wait. Until they actually reached the Black Hotel, maybe. Rushton's twinner, Jason's twinner. Yes, together they would reach the Talisman's home and prison. "Well, all right," he said. "Can you walk okay?" "I guess so." "Good. Because there's something I want to do now, since you're not dying of a brain tumor anymore, I mean, and I need your help." "What's that?" Richard asked. He wiped his face with a trembling hand. "I want to open up one or two of those cases on the flat car and see if we can get ourselves some weapons." "I hate and detest guns," Richard said. "You should, too. If nobody had any guns, your father..." "Yeah, and if pigs had wings, they'd fly," Jack said. "I'm pretty sure somebody's following us." "Well, maybe it's my dad," Richard said in a hopeful voice. Jack grunted and eased the little gear shift out of the first slot. The train appreciably began to lose power. When it had coasted to a halt, Jack put the shift in neutral. "Can you climb down okay, do you think?" "Oh, sure," Richard said, and stood up too quickly. His legs bowed out at the knees, and he sat down hard on the bench. His face now seemed even grayer than it had been, and moisture shone on his forehead and upper lip. "Ah, maybe not," he whispered. "Just take it easy," Jack said, and moved beside him and placed one hand on the crook of his elbow, the other on Richard's damp, warm forehead. "Relax." Richard closed his eyes briefly, then looked into Jack's own eyes with an expression of perfect trust. "I tried to do it too fast," he said. "I'm all pins and needles from staying in the same position for so long." "Nice and easy, then," Jack said, and helped a hissing Richard get to his feet. "Hurts! Only for a little while. I need your help, Richard." Richard experimentally stepped forward and hissed in air again. "Ouch!" He moved the other leg forward. Then he leaned forward slightly and slapped his palms against his thighs and calves. As Jack watched, Richard's face altered, but this time not with pain. A look of almost rubbery astonishment had printed itself there. Jack followed the direction of his friend's eyes and saw one of the featherless, monkey-faced birds gliding past the front of the train. "Yeah, there are a lot of funny things out here," Jack said. "I'm going to feel a lot better if we can find some guns under that tarp." "What do you suppose is on the other side of those hills?" Richard asked. "More of the same?" "No, I think there are more people over there," Jack said. "If you can call them people. I've caught somebody watching us twice." At the expression of quick panic which flooded into Richard's face, Jack said, "I don't think it was anybody from your school, but it could be something just as bad. I'm not trying to scare you, buddy, but I've seen a little more of the blasted lands than you have." "The blasted lands," Richard said dubiously. He squinted out at the red, dusty valley with its scabrous patches of piss-colored grass.
"Oh, that tree,
"I know," Jack said. "You have to just sort of learn to ignore it."
"Who on earth would create this kind of devastation?" Richard asked. "This isn't natural, you know."
"Maybe we'll find out someday." Jack helped Richard leave the cab, so that both stood on a narrow running board that covered the tops of the wheels. "Don't get down in that dust," he warned Richard. "We don't know how deep it is. I don't want to have to pull you out of it." Richard shuddered, but it may have been because he had just noticed out of the side of his eye another of the screaming, anguished trees. Together, the two boys edged along the side of the stationary train until they could swing onto the coupling of the empty boxcar. From there, a narrow metal ladder led to the roof of the car. On the boxcar's far end, another ladder let them descend to the flat car. Jack pulled at the thick, hairy rope, trying to remember how Anders had loosened it so easily.
"I think it's here," Richard said, holding up a twisted loop like a hangman's noose.
"Jack, give it a try." Richard was not strong enough to loosen the knot by himself, but when Jack helped him tug on the protruding cord, the noose smoothly disappeared, and the tarpaulin collapsed over the nest of boxes. Jack pulled the edge back over those closest, machine parts, and over a smaller set of boxes Jack had not seen before, marked lenses.
"There they are," he said. "I just wish we had a crowbar."
He glanced up toward the rim of the valley, and a tortured tree opened its mouth and silently yowled. Was that another head up there, peering over? It might have been one of the enormous worms sliding toward them.
"Come on, let's try to push the top off one of these boxes," he said, and Richard meekly came toward him.
After 6 mighty heaves against the top of one of the crates, Jack finally felt movement and heard the nails creak. Richard continued to strain at his side of the box.
"That's all right," Jack said to him.
Richard seemed even grayer and less healthy than he had before exerting himself.
"I'll get it next push."
Richard stepped back and almost collapsed over one of the smaller boxes. He straightened himself and began to probe further under the loose tarpaulin. Jack set himself before the tall box and clamped his jaw shut. He placed his hands on the corner of the lid. After taking in a long breath, he pushed up until his muscles began to shake. Just before he was going to have to ease up, the nails creaked again and began to slide out of the wood. Jack yelled, "Ah!" and heaved the top off the box. Stacked inside the carton, slimy with grease, were 6 guns of a sort Jack had never seen before. Like grease guns metamorphosing into butterflies, half mechanical, half insectile. He pulled one out and looked at it more closely, trying to see if he could figure out how it worked. It was an automatic weapon, so it would need a clip. He bent down and used the barrel of the weapon to pry off the top of one of the lenses cartons. As he had expected, in the second, smaller box stood a little pile of heavily greased clips packed in plastic beads.
"It's an Uzi," Richard said behind him. "Israeli machine gun. Pretty fashionable weapon, I gather. The terrorist's favorite toy."
"How do you know that?" Jack asked, reaching in for another of the guns.
"I watch television. How do you think?"
Jack experimented with the clip, at first trying to fit it into the cavity upside down, then finding the correct position. Next, he found the safety and clicked it off, then on again.
"Those things are so damn ugly," Richard said.
"You get one too, so don't complain." Jack took a second clip for Richard, and after a moment's consideration, took all the clips out of the box, put 2 in his pockets, tossed 2 to Richard, who managed to catch them both, and slid the remaining clips into his haversack.
"Ugh,"
Richard said. "I guess it's insurance," Jack said. Richard collapsed on the seat as soon as they got back to the cab. The trips up and down the 2 ladders and inching along the narrow strip of metal above the wheels had taken nearly all of his energy. But he made room for Jack to sit down, and watched with heavy-lidded eyes while his friend started the train rolling again. Jack picked up his serape and began massaging his gun with it.
"What are you doing?"
"Rubbing the grease off. You'd better do it too when I'm done."
For the rest of the day, the two boys sat in the open cab of the train, sweating, trying not to take into account the wailing trees, the corrupt stink of the passing landscape, their hunger. Jack noticed that a little garden of open sores had bloomed around Richard's mouth. Finally, Jack took Richard's Uzi from his hand, wiped it free of grease, and pushed in the clip. Sweat burned saltily in cracks on his lips. Jack closed his eyes. Maybe he had not seen those heads peering over the rim of the valley. Maybe they were not followed, after all. He heard the batteries sizzle and send off a big, snapping spark, and felt Richard jump at it. An instant later, he was asleep, dreaming of food. When Richard shook Jack's shoulder, bringing him up out of a world in which he had been eating a pizza the size of a truck tire, the shadows were just beginning to spread across the valley, softening the agony of the wailing trees. Even they, bending low and spreading their hands across their faces, seemed beautiful in the low receding light. The deep red dust shimmered and glowed. The shadows printed themselves out along it, almost perceptibly lengthening. The terrible yellow grass was melting toward an almost mellow orange. Fading red sunlight painted itself slantingly along the rocks at the valley's rim. "I just thought you might want to see this," Richard said. A few more small sores seemed to have appeared about his mouth. Richard grinned weakly. "It seemed sort of special. The spectrum, I mean." Jack feared that Richard was going to launch into a scientific explanation of the color shift at sunset, but his friend was too tired or sick for physics. In silence, the two boys watched the twilight deepen all the colors about them, turning the western sky into purple glory. "You know what else you're carrying on this thing?" Richard asked. "What else?" Jack asked. In truth, he hardly cared. It could be nothing good. He hoped he might live to see another sunset as rich as this one, as large with feeling. "Plastic explosive. All wrapped up in 2-pound packages. I think 2 pounds, anyhow. You've got enough to blow up a whole city. If one of these guns goes off accidentally, or if someone else puts a bullet into those bags, this train is going to be nothing but a hole in the ground." "I won't if you won't," Jack said, and let himself be taken by the sunset. It seemed oddly premonitory, a dream of accomplishment, and led him into memories of all he had undergone since leaving the Alhambra Inn and Gardens. He saw his mother drinking tea in the little shop, suddenly a tired old woman, Speedy Parker sitting at the base of a tree, Wolf tending his herd, Smokey and Laurie from Oatley's horrible tap, all the hated faces from the Sunlight Home, Hack Bast, Sonny Singer, and the others. He missed Wolf with a particular and sharp poignancy, for the unfolding and deepening sunset summoned him up wholly, though Jack could not have explained why. He wished he could take Richard's hand. Then he thought, well, why not? And moved his hand along the bench until he encountered his friend's rather grubby, clammy paw. He closed his fingers around it. "I feel so sick," Richard said. "This isn't like before. My stomach feels terrible, and my whole face is tingling." "I think you'll get better once we finally get out of this place," Jack said. "But what proof do you have of that, Doctor?" he wondered. "What proof do you have that you're not just poisoning him?" He had none. He consoled himself with his newly invented, newly discovered idea that Richard was an essential part of whatever was going to happen at the Black Hotel. He was going to need Richard Sloat, and not just because Richard Sloat could tell plastic explosive from bags of fertilizer. Had Richard ever been to the Black Hotel before? Had he actually been in the Talisman's vicinity? He glanced over at his friend, who was breathing shallowly and laboriously. Richard's hand lay in his own like a cold waxen sculpture. "I don't want this gun anymore," Richard said, pushing it off his lap. "The smell is making me sick." "Okay," Jack said, taking it onto his own lap with his free hand. One of the trees crept into his peripheral vision and howled soundlessly in torment. Soon the mutant dogs would begin foraging. Jack glanced up toward the hills to his left, Richard's side, and saw a man-like figure slipping through the rocks. "Hey," he said, almost not believing. Indifferent to his shock, the lurid sunset continued to beautify the unbeautifiable. "Hey, Richard."
"What?
You sick, too? I think I saw somebody up there, on your side." He peered up at the tall rocks again, but saw no movement.
"I don't care," Richard said. "You'd better care. See how they're timing it? They want to get to us just when it's too dark for us to see them."
Richard cracked his left eye open and made a half-hearted inspection.
"Don't see anybody."
"Neither do I now, but I'm glad we went back and got these guns. Sit up straight and pay attention, Richard, if you want to get out of this alive."
"You're such a cornball, jeez."
But Richard did pull himself up straight and open both his eyes.
"I really don't see anything up there, Jack. It's getting too dark. You probably imagined..."
"Hush," Jack said. He thought he had seen another body easing itself between the rocks at the valley's top.
"There's two. I wonder if there'll be another one."
"I wonder if there'll be anything at all," Richard said. "Why would anyone want to hurt us anyhow? I mean, it's not..." Jack turned his head and looked down the tracks ahead of the train. Something moved behind the trunk of one of the screaming trees. Something larger than a dog, Jack recorded.
"Uh-oh," Jack said. "I think another guy is up there, waiting for us."
For a moment, fear castrated him. He could not think of what to do to protect himself from the three assailants. His stomach froze. He picked up the Uzi from his lap and looked at it dumbly, wondering if he really would be able to use this weapon. Could Blasted Land's hijackers have guns, too?
"Richard, I'm sorry," he said, "but this time I think the shit is really going to hit the fan, and I'm going to need your help."
"What can I do?" Richard asked, his voice squeaky.
"Take your gun," Jack said, handing it to him. "And I think we ought to kneel down so we don't give them so much of a target."
He got on his knees, and Richard imitated him in a slow-moving, underwater fashion. From behind them came a long cry, from above them another.
"They know we saw them," Richard said. "But where are they?"
The question was almost immediately answered. Still visible in the dark, purplish twilight, a man, or what looked like a man, burst out of cover and began running down the slope toward the train. Rags fluttered out behind him. He was screaming like an Indian and raising something in his hands. It appeared to be a flexible pole, and Jack was still trying to work out its function when he heard, more than saw, a narrow shape slice through the air beside his head.
"Holy mackerel! They've got bows and arrows," he said.
Richard groaned, and Jack feared that he would vomit all over both of them.
"I have to shoot him," he said.
Richard gulped and made some noise that wasn't quite a word.
"Oh, hell," Jack said, and flicked off the safety on his Uzi.
He raised his head and saw the ragged being behind him just loosing off another arrow. If the shot had been accurate, he would never have seen another thing, but the arrow whanged harmlessly into the side of the cab. Jack jerked up the Uzi and depressed the trigger. He expected none of what happened. He had thought that the gun would remain still in his hands and obediently expel a few shells. Instead, the Uzi jumped in his hands like an animal, making a series of noises loud enough to damage his eardrums. The stink of powder burned in his nose. The ragged man behind the train threw out his arms, but in amazement, not because he had been wounded. Jack finally thought to take his finger off the trigger. He had no idea of how many shots he had just wasted or how many bullets remained in the clip.
"Did you get him? Did you get him?" Richard asked.
The man was now running up the side of the valley, huge flat feet flapping. Then Jack saw that they were not feet. The man was walking on huge plate-like constructions, the Blasted Land's equivalent of snowshoes. He was trying to make it to one of the trees for cover. He raised the Uzi with both hands and sighted down the short barrel. Then he gently squeezed the trigger. The gun bucked in its hands, but less than the first time. Bullets sprayed out in a wide arc, and at least one of them found its intended target, for the man lurched over sideways as though a truck had just smacked into him. His feet flew out of the snowshoes.
"Give me your gun," Jack said, and took the second Uzi from Richard. Still kneeling, he fired half a clip into the shadowy dark in front of the train and hoped he had killed the creature waiting up there.
Another arrow rattled against the train, and another thunked solidly into the side of the boxcar. Richard was shaking and crying in the bottom of the cab. "Load mine," Jack said, and jammed a clip from his pocket under Richard's nose. He peered up the side of the valley for the second attacker. In less than a minute, it would be too dark to see anything beneath the rim of the valley.
"I see him," Richard shouted. "I saw him right there."
He pointed toward a shadow moving silently, urgently among the rocks, and Jack spent the rest of the second Uzi's clip noisily blasting at it. When he was done, Richard took the machine gun from him and placed the other in his hands.
"Nice boys, good boys," came a voice from the right side. How far ahead of them, it was impossible to tell. "You stop now. I stop now, too, get it? All done now, this business. You nice boys. Maybe you sell me that gun. You kill plenty good that way, I see."
"Jack," Richard whispered frantically, warning him.
"Throw away the bow and arrows," Jack yelled, still crouching beside Richard.
"Jack, you can't," Richard whispered.
"I throw them away now,"
the voice came, still ahead of them. Something light puffed into the dust.
"You boys stop going. Sell me gun, get it?"
"Okay," Jack said. "Come up here where we can see you."
"Get it,"
the voice said. Jack pulled back on the gear shift, letting the train coast to a halt. "When I holler," he whispered to Richard, "jam it forward as fast as you can, okay?"
"Oh, Jesus," Richard breathed.
Jack checked that the safety was off on the gun Richard had just given him. A trickle of sweat ran from his forehead directly into his right eye.
"All good now, yes," the voice said. "Boys can sit up, yes, sit up, boys."
Wake up, please, please." The train coasted toward the speaker.
"Put your hand on the shift," Jack whispered. "It's coming soon."
Richard's trembling hand, looking too small and childlike to accomplish anything even slightly important, touched the gear lever. Jack had a sudden, vivid memory of old Anders kneeling before him on a rippling wooden floor, asking, "But will you be safe, my lord?" He had answered flippantly, hardly taking the question seriously. What were the blasted lands to a boy who had humped out kegs for Smoky Updike? Now he was a lot more afraid that he was going to soil his pants than that Richard was going to lose his lunch all over the territory's version of Miles P. Kiger's loden coat. A shout of laughter erupted in the darkness beside the cab, and Jack pulled himself upright, bringing up the gun, and yelled just as a heavy body hit the side of the cab and clung there. Richard shoved the gear shift forward, and the train jerked forward. A naked, hairy arm clamped itself on the side of the cab. So much for the Wild West, Jack thought, and then the man's entire trunk reared up over them. Richard screeched, and Jack very nearly did evacuate his bowels into his underwear. The face was nearly all teeth. It was a face as instinctively evil as that of a rattler baring its fangs, and a drop of what Jack as instinctively assumed to be venom fell off of one of the long, curved teeth. Except for the tiny nose, the creature looming over the boys looked very like a man with the head of a snake. In one webbed hand, he raised a knife. Jack squeezed off an aimless, panicky shot. Then the creature altered and wavered back for a moment, and it took Jack a fraction of a second to see that the webbed hand and the knife were gone. The creature swung forward a bloody stump and left a smear of red on Jack's shirt. Jack's mind conveniently left him, and his fingers were able to point the Uzi straight at the creature's chest and pull the trigger back. A great hole opened redly in the middle of the mottled chest, and the dripping teeth snapped together. Jack kept the trigger depressed, and the Uzi raised its barrel by itself and destroyed the creature's head in a second or two of total carnage. Then it was gone. Only a large blood stain on the side of the cab and the smear of blood on Jack's shirt showed that the two boys had not dreamed the entire encounter.
"Watch out!" Richard yelled.
"I got him," Jack breathed.
"Where'd he go?"
"He fell off," Jack said. "He's dead."
"You shot his hand off," Richard whispered. "How'd you do that?"
Jack held up his hands before him and saw how they shook. The stink of gunpowder encased them. "I just sort of imitated someone with good aim." He put his hands down and licked his lips. 12 hours later, as the sun came up again over the blasted lands, neither boy had slept. They had spent the entire night as rigid as soldiers, holding their guns in their laps and straining to hear the smallest of noises. Remembering how much ammunition the train was carrying, every now and then Jack randomly aimed a few rounds at the lip of the valley. And that second entire day, if there were people or monsters in this far sector of the blasted lands, they let the boys pass unmolested. Which could mean, Jack tiredly thought, that they knew about the guns. Or that out here, so near to the western shore, nobody wanted to mess with Morgan's train. He said none of this to Richard, whose eyes were filmy and unfocused, and who seemed feverish much of the time. By evening of that day, Jack began to smell salt water in the acrid air. Chapter 36. Jack and Richard Go to War. The sunset that night was wider. The land had begun to open out again as they approached the ocean, but not so spectacular. Jack stopped the train at the top of an eroded hill and climbed back to the flat car again. He poked about for nearly an hour, until the sullen colors had faded from the sky and a quarter moon had risen in the east, and brought back six boxes, all marked lenses. "Open those," he told Richard. "Get a count. You're appointed keeper of the clips." "Marvelous," Richard said in a wan voice. "I knew I was getting all that education for something." Jack went back to the flat car again and pried up the lid of one of the crates marked machine parts. While he was doing this, he heard a harsh, hoarse cry somewhere off in the darkness, followed by a shrill scream of pain. "Jack? Jack, you back there?" "Right here," Jack called. He thought it very unwise for the two of them to be yelling back and forth like a couple of washerwomen over a back fence, but Richard's voice suggested that he was close to panicking. "You coming back pretty soon?" "Be right there," Jack called, levering faster and harder with the Uzi's barrel. They were leaving the blasted lands behind, but Jack still didn't want to stand at a stop for too long. It would have been simpler if he could have just carried the box of machine guns back to the engine, but it was too heavy. "They ain't heavy, they're my Uzis," Jack thought, and giggled a little in the dark. "Jack!" Richard's voice was high-pitched, frantic. "Hold your water, chum," he said. "Don't call me chum," Richard said. Nails shrieked out of the crate's lid, and it came up enough for Jack to be able to pull it off. He grabbed two of the grease guns and was starting back when he saw another box. It was about the size of a portable TV carton. A fold of the tarp had covered it previously. Jack went skittering across the top of the boxcar under the faint moonlight, feeling the breeze blow into his face. It was clean, no taint of rotted perfume, no feeling of corruption, just clean dampness and the unmistakable scent of salt. "What were you doing?" Richard scolded. "Jack, we have guns and we have bullets. Why did you want to go back and get more? Something could have climbed up here while you were playing around." "More guns because machine guns have a tendency to overheat," Jack said. "More bullets because we may have to shoot a lot. I watch TV too, you see." He started back toward the flat car again. He wanted to see what was in that square box. Richard grabbed him. Panic turned his hand into a bird-like talon. "Richard, it's going to be all right. Something might grab you off." "I think we're almost out of the bl- Something might grab me off. Jack, don't leave me alone." Richard burst into tears. He did not turn away from Jack or put his hands to his face. He only stood there, his face twisted, his eyes spouting tears. He looked cruelly naked to Jack just then. Jack folded him into his arms and held him. "If something gets you and kills you, what happens to me?" Richard sobbed. "How would I ever, ever get out of this place?" "I don't know," Jack thought. "I really don't know." So Richard came with him on Jack's last trip to the traveling ammo dump on the flat car. This meant boosting him up the ladder and then supporting him along the top of the boxcar and helping him carefully down, as one might help a crippled old lady across a street. Rational Richard was making a mental comeback, but physically he was growing steadily worse. Although preservative grease was bleeding out between its boards, the square box was marked fruit. Nor was that completely inaccurate, Jack discovered when they got it open. The box was full of pineapples. The exploding kind. "Holy Hannah," Richard whispered. "Whoever she is," Jack agreed. "Help me, I think we can each get 4 or 5 down our shirts." "Why do you want all this firepower?" Richard asked. "Are you expecting to fight an army?"
"Something like that."
Richard looked up into the sky as he and Jack were recrossing the top of the boxcar, and a wave of faintness overtook him. Richard tottered, and Jack had to grab him to keep him from toppling over the side. He had realized that he could recognize constellations of neither the northern hemisphere nor the southern. Those were alien stars up there. But there were patterns, and somewhere in this unknown, unbelievable world, sailors might be navigating by them. It was that thought which brought the reality of all this home to Richard, brought it home with a final, undeniable thud. Then Jack's voice was calling him back from far away.
"Hey, Richie! Jason! You almost fell over the side!"
Finally, they were in the cab again. Jack pushed the lever into the forward gear, pressed down on the accelerator bar, and Morgan of Oris's oversized flashlight started to move forward again. Jack glanced down at the floor of the cab. 4 Uzi machine guns, almost 20 piles of clips, 10 to a pile, and 10 hand grenades with pull pins that looked like the pop-tops of beer cans. "If we haven't got enough stuff now," Jack said, "we might as well forget it."
"What are you expecting, Jack?"
Jack only shook his head.
"Guess you must think I'm a real jerk, huh?" Richard asked.
Jack grinned.
"Always have, chum. Don't call me chum. Chum, chum, chum."
This time the old joke raised a small smile. Not much, and it rather highlighted the growing line of lip blisters on Richard's mouth, but better than nothing.
"Will you be okay if I go back to sleep?" Richard asked, brushing machine gun clips aside and settling in a corner of the cab with Jack Serape over him. "All that climbing and carrying. I think I really must be sick because I feel really bushed."
"I'll be fine," Jack said. Indeed, he seemed to be getting a second wind. He supposed he would need it before long.
"I can smell the ocean," Richard said.
And in his voice, Jack heard an amazing mixture of love, loathing, nostalgia, and fear. Richard's eyes slipped closed. Jack pushed the accelerator bar all the way down. His feeling that the end, some sort of end, was now close, had never been stronger. The last mean and miserable vestiges of the blasted lands were gone before the moon set. The grain had reappeared. It was coarser here than it had been in Ellis Breaks, but it still radiated a feeling of cleanness and health. Jack heard the faint calling of birds which sounded like gulls. It was an inexpressibly lonely sound in these great, open, rolling fields which smelled faintly of fruit and more pervasively of ocean salt. After midnight, the train began to hum through stands of trees. Most of them were evergreens, and their piney scent, mixed with the salty tang in the air, seemed to cement the connection between this place he was coming to and the place from which he had set out. He and his mother had never spent a great deal of time in Northern California, perhaps because bloat vacationed there often, but he remembered Lily's telling him that the land around Mendocino and Sausalito looked very much like New England, right down to the salt boxes and Cape Cods. Film companies in need of New England settings usually just went upstate, rather than traveling all the way across the country, and most audiences never knew the difference.
"This is how it should be. In a weird way, I'm coming back to the place I left behind."
"Richard, are you expecting to fight an army?" He was glad Richard had gone to sleep, so he wouldn't have to answer that question. At least not yet.
"Anders, devil things, for the bad wolves to take to the Black Hotel."
The devil things were Uzi machine guns, plastic explosive, grenades. The devil things were here. The bad wolves were not. The boxcar, however, was empty, and Jack found that fact terribly persuasive. "Here's a story for you, Richie boy, and I'm very glad you're asleep so I don't have to tell it to you. Morgan knows I'm coming, and he's planning a surprise party. Only it's werewolves instead of naked girls who are going to jump out of the cake. And they're supposed to have Uzi machine guns and grenades as party favors. Well, we sort of hijacked his train, and we're running 10 or 12 hours ahead of schedule. But if we're heading into an encampment full of wolves waiting to catch the territory's choo-choo, and I think that's just what we're doing, we're going to need all the surprise we can get." Jack ran a hand up the side of his face. It would be easier to stop the train well away from wherever Morgan's hit squad was and make a big circle around the encampment. Easier and safer, too. But that would leave the bad wolves around, Richie. Can you dig it? He looked down at the arsenal on the floor of the cab and wondered if he could really be planning a commando raid on Morgan's wolf brigade. Some commandos, good old Jack Sawyer, king of the vagabond dishwashers, and his comatose sidekick, Richard. Jack wondered if he had gone crazy. He supposed he had, because that was exactly what he was planning. It would be the last thing any of them would expect. And there had been too much. Too much, too goddamn much. He had been whipped, Wolf had been killed, they had destroyed Richard's school and most of Richard's sanity. And for all he knew, Morgan Sloat was back in New Hampshire, harrying his mother. Crazy or not, payback time had come. Jack bent over, picked up one of the loaded Uzis, and held it over his arm as the tracks unrolled in front of him, and the smell of salt grew steadily stronger. During the small hours of the morning, Jack slept a while, leaning against the accelerator bar. It would not have comforted him much to know such a device was called a dead man's switch. When dawn came, it was Richard who woke him up. "Something up ahead." Before looking at that, Jack took a good look at Richard. He had hoped that Richard would look better in daylight, but not even the cosmetic of dawn could disguise the fact that Richard was sick. The color of the new day had changed the dominant color in his skin tone from gray to yellow. That was all.
"Hey, train! Hello, you big fucking train!"
This shout was guttural, little more than an animal roar. Jack looked forward again. They were closing in on a narrow little pillbox of a building. Standing outside the guardhouse was a wolf, but any resemblance to Jack's wolf ended with the flaring orange eyes. This wolf's head looked dreadfully flattened, as if a great hand had scythed off the curve of skull at the top. His face seemed to jut over his underslung jaw like a boulder teetering over a long drop. Even the present surprised joy on that face could not conceal its thick, brutal stupidity. Braided pigtails of hair hung from his cheeks. A scar in the shape of an X rode his forehead. The wolf was wearing something like a mercenary's uniform, or what he imagined a mercenary's uniform would look like. Baggy green pants were bloused out over black boots, but the toes of the boots had been cut off, Jack saw, to allow the wolf's long-nailed, hairy toes to protrude.
"Train!"
he barked-growled as the engine closed the last 50 yards. He began to jump up and down, grinning savagely. He was snapping his fingers like Cab Calloway. Foam flew from his jaws in unlovely clots.
"Train! Train! Fucking train! Right here and now!"
His mouth yawned open in a great and alarming grin, showing a mouthful of broken yellow spears.
"You guys some kind of fucking early, okay? Okay?"
"Jack, what is it?" Richard asked. His hand was clutching Jack's shoulder with panicky tightness, but to his credit, his voice was fairly even. "It's a wolf, one of Morgan's." "There, Jack, you said his name, asshole." But there was no time to worry about that now. They were coming abreast of the guardhouse, and the wolf obviously meant to swing aboard. As Jack watched, he cut a clumsy caper in the dust, cut off boots thumping. He had a knife in the leather belt he wore across his naked chest like a bandolier, but no gun. Jack flicked the control on the Uzi to single fire.
"Morgan? Who's Morgan? Which Morgan?"
"Not now," Jack said. His concentration narrowed down to a fine point, the wolf. He manufactured a big plastic grin for his benefit, holding the Uzi down and well out of sight.
Anders Train, all fucking right, here and now!
A handle like a big staple stuck off from the right side of the engine, above a wide step like a running board. Grinning wildly, drizzling foam over his chin and obviously insane, the wolf grabbed the handle and leaped lightly up onto the step.
Hey, where's the old man, wolf?
Where's Jack raised the Uzi and put a bullet into the wolf's left eye. The glaring orange light puffed out like a candle flame in a strong gust of wind. The wolf fell backward off the step like a man doing a rather stupid dive. He thudded loosely on the ground.
Jack!
Richard pulled him around. His face looked as wild as the wolf's face had been, only it was terror, not joy, that distorted it.
Did you mean my father? Is my father involved in this?
Richard, do you trust me?
Yes, but
then let it go. Let it go. This is not the time.
But get a gun.
Jack, Richard, get a gun. Richard bent over and got one of the Uzis.
I hate guns, he said again.
Yeah, I know. I'm not particularly keen on them myself, Richie boy. But it's payback time. The tracks were now approaching a high stockade wall. From behind it came grunts and yells, cheers, rhythmic clapping, the sound of boot heels punching down on bare earth in steady rhythms. There were other, less identifiable sounds as well, but all of them fell into a vague set for Jack, military training operation. The area between the guardhouse and the approaching stockade wall was half a mile wide, and with all this other stuff going on, Jack doubted that anyone had heard his single shot. The train, being electric, was almost silent. The advantage of surprise should still be on their side. The tracks disappeared beneath a closed double gate in the side of the stockade wall. Jack could see chinks of daylight between the rough-peeled logs.
Jack, you better slow down.
They were now 150 yards from the gate. From behind it, bellowing voices chanted,
Sound off, hunt, 2, 3, 4, sound off.
Jack thought again of H.G. Wells's Manimals and shivered.
No way, chum. We're through the gate. You got just about time to do the fish cheer.
Jack, you're crazy.
I know.
100 yards. The batteries hummed. A blue spark jumped, sizzling. Bare earth flowed past them on either side. No grain here, Jack thought. If Noel Coward had written a play about Morgan Sloat, I guess he would have called it Blight Spirit.
Jack, what if this creepy little train jumps its tracks?
Well, it might, I guess, Jack said.
Or what if it breaks through the gate and the tracks just end?
That'd be one on us, wouldn't it? 50 yards.
Jack, you really have lost your mind, haven't you?
I guess so. Take your gun off safety, Richard. Richard flicked the safety. Thuds, grunts, marching men, the creak of leather, yells, an inhuman laughing shriek that made Richard cringe. And yet Jack saw a clear resolution in Richard's face that made Jack grin with pride. He means to stick by me. Old rational Richard or not, he really means to stick by me. 25 yards. Shrieks, squeals, shouted commands, and a thick reptilian cry, that made the hair stand up on the back of Jack's neck.
If we get out of this, Jack said, I'll buy you a chili dog at Dairy Queen.
Barf me out, Richard yelled, and incredibly he began to laugh. In that instant, the unhealthy yellow seemed to fade a bit from his face. 5 yards, and the peeled posts which made up the gate looked solid, yes, very solid, and Jack just had time to wonder if he hadn't made a great big fat mistake.
Get down, chum!
Don't come! The train hit the stockade gate, throwing them both forward. The gate was really quite strong, and in addition it was double-barred across the inside with 2 large logs. Morgan's train was not terribly big, and the batteries were nearly flat after its long run across the blasted lands. The collision surely would have derailed it, and both boys might well have been killed in the wreck, but the gate had an Achilles heel. new hinges, forged according to modern American processes, were on order. They had not yet arrived, however, and the old iron hinges snapped when the engine hit the gate. The train came rolling into the stockade at 25 miles an hour, pushing the amputated gate in front of it. An obstacle course had been built around the stockade's perimeter, and the gate, acting like a snowplow, began shoving makeshift wooden hurdles in front of it, turning them, rolling them, snapping them into splinters. It also struck a wolf who had been doing punishment laps. His feet disappeared under the bottom of the moving gate and were chewed off, customized boots and all. Shrieking and growling, his change beginning, the wolf began to claw-climb his way up the gate with fingernails which were growing rapidly to the length and sharpness of a telephone lineman's spikes. The gate was now 40 feet inside the stockade. Amazingly, he got almost to the top before Jack dropped the gear lever into neutral. The train stopped. The gate fell over, puffing up big dust and crushing the unfortunate wolf beneath it. Underneath the last car of the train, the wolf's severed feet continued to grow hair, and would for several more minutes. The situation inside the camp was better than Jack had dared hope. The place apparently woke up early, as military installations have a way of doing, and most of the troops seemed to be out, going through a bizarre menu of drills and bodybuilding exercises. "On the right!" he shouted at Richard. "Do what?" Richard shouted back. Jack opened his mouth and cried out. For Uncle Tommy Woodbine run down in the street. For an unknown carter whipped to death in a muddy courtyard. For Ferd Janklow. For Wolf, dead in Sunlight Gardener's filthy office. For his mother. But most of all, he discovered, for Queen Laura de Loessian, who was also his mother, and for the crime that was being carried out on the body of the territories. He cried out as Jason, and his voice was thunder. "Tear them up!" Jack Sawyer, Jason de Loessian, bellowed, and opened fire on the left. There was a rough parade ground on Jack's side, a long log building on Richard's. The log building looked like the bunkhouse in a Roy Rogers movie, but Richard guessed that it was a barracks. In fact, this whole place looked more familiar to Richard than anything he had seen so far in this weird world Jack had taken him into. He had seen places like it on the TV news. CIA-supported rebels training for takeovers of South and Central American countries trained in places like this. Only the training camps were usually in Florida, and those weren't Cubanos pouring out of the barracks. Richard didn't know what they were. Some of them looked a bit like medieval paintings of devils and satyrs. Some looked like degenerate human beings, cave people almost. And one of the things, lurching into the early morning sunlight, had scaly skin and nictitating eyelids. It looked to Richard Sloat like an alligator that was somehow walking upright. As he looked, the thing lifted its snout and uttered that cry he and Jack had heard earlier. "Grrr!" He just had time to see that most of these hellish creatures looked totally bewildered, and then Jack's Uzi split the world with thunder. On Jack's side, roughly 24 wolves had been doing callies on the parade ground. Like the guardhouse wolf, most wore green fatigue pants, boots with cut-off toes, and bandolier belts. Like the guard, they looked stupid, flat-headed, and essentially evil. They had paused in the middle of a spastic set of jumping jacks to watch the train come roaring in, the gate and the unfortunate fellow who had been running laps at the wrong place and time plastered to the front. At Jack's cry, they began to move, but by then they were too late. Most of Morgan's carefully culled Wolf Brigade, hand-picked over a period of 5 years for their strength and brutality, their fear of and loyalty to Morgan, were wiped out in one spitting, raking burst of the machine gun in Jack's hands. They went stumbling and reeling backward, chests blown open, heads bleeding. There were growls of bewildered anger and howls of pain, but not many. Most of them simply died. Jack popped the clip, grabbed another one, slammed it in. On the left side of the parade ground, 4 of the wolves had escaped. In the center, 2 more had dropped below the line of fire. Both of these had been wounded, but now were coming at him, long nailed toes digging divots in the packed dust, faces sprouting hair, eyes flaring. As they ran at the engine, Jack saw fangs grow out of their mouths and push through fresh, wiry hair growing from their chins. He pulled the trigger on the Uzi, now holding the hot barrel down only with an effort. The heavy recoil was trying to force the muzzle up. Both of the attacking wolves were thrown back so violently that they flipped through the air head for heels like acrobats. The other four wolves did not pause. They headed for the place where the gate had been 2 minutes before. The assorted creatures which had spilled out of the bunkhouse-style barracks building seemed to be finally getting the idea that although the newcomers were driving Morgan's train, they were a good deal less than friendly. There was no concentrated charge, but they began to move forward in a muttering clot. Richard laid the Uzi's barrel on the chest-high side of the engine cab and opened fire. The slugs tore them open, drove them backward. Two of the things which looked like goats dropped to hands and knees, or hooves, and scurried back inside. Richard saw three others spin and drop under the force of the slugs. A joy so savage that it made him feel faint swept through him. Bullets also tore open the whitish-green belly of the alligator thing, and a blackish fluid, ichor, not blood, began to pour out of it. It fell backward, but its tail seemed to cushion it. It sprang back up and leaped at Richard's side of the train. It uttered its rough, powerful cry again, and this time it seemed to Richard that there was something hideously feminine in that cry. He pulled the trigger of the Uzi. Nothing happened. The clip was spent. The alligator thing ran with slow, clumsy, thudding determination. Its eyes sparkled with murderous fury and intelligence. The vestiges of breasts bounced on its scaly chest. He bent, groped, without taking his eyes off the were-alligator, and found one of the grenades. Seabrook Island, Richard thought dreamily. Jack calls this place the Territories, but it's really Seabrook Island, and there is no need to be afraid, really no need. This is all a dream, and if that thing's scaly claws settle around my neck, I will surely wake up. And even if it's not all a dream, Jack will save me somehow. I know he will. I know it, because over here Jack is some kind of a god. He pulled the pin on the grenade, restrained the strong urge he felt to simply chuck it in a panicky frenzy, and lobbed it gently, underhand. "Jack, get down!" Jack dropped below the level of the engine cab's sides at once, without looking. Richard did, too, but not before he had seen an incredible, blackly comic thing. The alligator creature had caught the grenade and was trying to eat it. The explosion was not the dull crump Richard had expected, but a loud, braying roar that drilled into his ears, hurting them badly. He heard a splash, as if someone had thrown a bucket of water against his side of the train. He looked up and saw that the engine, boxcar, and flat car were covered with hot guts, black blood, and shreds of the alligator creature's flesh. The entire front of the barracks building had been blown away. Much of the splintered rubble was bloody. In the midst of it, he saw a hairy foot in a boot with a cut-off toe. The jackstraw blowdown of logs was thrown aside as he watched, and two of the goat-like creatures began to pull themselves out. Richard bent, found a fresh clip, and slammed it into his gun. It was getting hot, just as Jack had said it would. "Whoopee!" Richard thought faintly, and opened fire again.